At one point, I was so poor, I had to apply for a grant to buy a bed. I remember someone quite senior at Radio Leeds saying, I'm not sure you're really BBC. Colonels in the shires condemning me for my indulgence of the young.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Helen Bowden.
So radio, genuinely, because I'm a woman born in the 50s, and we did not have television in our house till I was 11, and then my father, being a Yorkshireman, was so bloody mean, he wouldn't pay for an outside aerial. So we spent hours trying to watch films on the telly through snow, making my little brother hold the aerial, going, no, move to the right, move to the left. So really, you know, in those kinds of circumstances, radio was always going to predominate, and I have sort of abiding memories which are relevant. So I remember dancing around the kitchen with my mum when I must have been four to My Fair Lady, because although she didn't like musical theatre, and I actually adore musical theatre, she did like My Fair Lady. And I remember her talking about the light programme and the home service, because when you're a child, those words are totally meaningless in an adult sense. And so I didn't understand what this light programme was. I thought it was something that floated.
This is the BBC light programme.
And the home service, what on earth could that be? And I also have a very strong memory, and again, I think this must have been before I was six, that the Archers music would come on. And it was at the Archers music coming on, so they were clearly listening to the home service at that point. Clara and my sister and I would go to bed. I mean, not resentfully going to bed, it was just... And I think one of the reasons I have a very strong affinity to speech radio is I learned to listen very young. When I was controller of Radio 4, you discover that if you're not raised with Radio 4, it's genuinely difficult to hear it in the same way. I mean, you get there.
Radio 4, we present The Archers.
But my husband, who did not grow up with the Home Service or Radio 4, or very little of it, working class boy from Wigan, Radio 4 would not have been on in his home very often, found, for example, The Archers utterly incomprehensible. We've been together for over 35 years, and, you know, I was obviously listening to The Archers when he met me.
How are you feeling? Oh, not too bad, all things considered. I've still got that stiff neck.
That's because you will sit in this chair when you're watching the television.
And he used to listen to it, and he couldn't tell the difference between the actors, whereas to me it was blindingly obvious. He formed a strong attachment to Captain the Dog, because it was a clear character. So I think in my background it was on a lot, but I wasn't actually that aware of it. The other thing was, music radio wasn't really what my parents were into, despite the My Fair Lady. But I was a child who loved classical music. I used to dance around the sitting room to Swan Lake. It's a lot of dancing. And I went to the Co-op Juniors Ballet School, Ballet and Tap. But my half-brother and half-sister loved Radio Luxembourg. You know, we were in a little house. We didn't have a lot of money. And there was quite a lot of listening under the bedclothes that I remember. But I didn't have that experience that some colleagues have of really, really falling passionately in love with pop music radio stations. And a lot of people in my generation really did. I was hooked to this storytelling. I loved storytelling. I loved the sound of the human voice. It's worth knowing that when I was a really small child, probably because I came from quite a complicated family with lots of half-siblings and a very tense marriage between my parents, I was very, very withdrawn. So the first school I went to, they thought I was educationally subnormal, and they put me on a separate table to play with dolls, because I was obviously so stupid, I couldn't learn to read. And then we moved, and I went to another school. I remember a wonderful teacher called Mrs. Cheadle. And there, I was so nervous, I just sat under the table and wouldn't come out. And eventually, someone worked out that I wasn't stupid, I was just very, very short-sighted. So school was terrifying, because I couldn't see my feet in focus, let alone the blackboard or the people. So I just shut down. And once I got some of those little round NHS glasses, not attractive, but sort of cute in a kind of way, my world was transformed. So I do know the power of the oral, but I also know the power of the visual.
Good morning, children. Will you scatter yourselves over the whole room so that each one of you has plenty of space for movement?
Well, school is interesting, of course, for the other thing, which is music and movement. So music and movement was on the radio, and you'd go around in your navy knickers and your little Airtex light blue shirt, and you'd be a raindrop or you'd be a sunbeam. And again, I realise now a lot of that was actually helping children listen properly. So that was very important, I think, both for us generationally, but also as a connection to radio.
Think of the floor as a large white sheet of paper, and yourself as the pencil, drawing shapes as you march.
I left school and went to be an au pair girl in Brussels.
Off you go.
And radio really wasn't important during that period. I mean, being an au pair girl is incredibly tedious. Do you know, I don't think I've ever been more lonely in my life. You have to remember there was no mobile phones and phoning home was incredibly expensive. My dear mum used to send me a letter every week. But I was really lonely. So I went to an Amdram group because I was meant to be learning French in Brussels, but actually I was with an American family and met some wonderful Americans. And that was very good. And I also met some very nice Americans who took me to lots of seriously good music. I went to see, do you remember Patti LaBelle? So I adored Patti LaBelle. I've always loved black music, sort of that dance, mainstream pop black music. And we did a lot of that. And also Ray Charles. I mean, I had an education around music, which played in later, if you like, in terms of having very eclectic tastes in music radio. But when I went to Sussex, to university, I went to work on campus radio. And again, it was interesting because lots and lots of people wanted to go to campus radio to do music programmes. And I wanted to go and do the journalism. And I remember doing this programme about abortion, the woman's right to abortion, which, looking back on it, was probably quite a bold thing to do. And even then, I knew in my heart you couldn't do biased programming. You had to try and get all sides of the story. I look back and I think I was only 19. It was quite interesting that I had an instinct for sort of fairness. I knew it couldn't be propaganda. And I also knew it had to be compelling. One of the things that all radio has actually is it's about the quality of listening. So whether it's music or speech, obviously particularly in speech, but you know, if you listen to Ken Bruce or if you listen to Wogan, God bless him, the quality of their listening is really profound. They hear in the note of the, you know, when they're doing stuff with their audiences or their interviewees, they really get that you have to listen hard. Not effortfully, but you have to hear properly. And I think I started learning that very early, and I think that campus radio experience was great.
This is the BBC's third programme. How to listen, including how not to, how you ought to, and how you won't.
I then went to New York, where I was an illegal alien. Luckily, there were no computers, so I've never had any trouble getting back in. God, and I worked hard. I worked in a toy shop. I cleaned people's hallways. It was a really hard life, but I joined a listener-sponsored radio station, which meant you got no pay whatsoever. But every Wednesday on my day off, I would turn up at this bonkers radio station and be sent on reporting assignments. I think they were baffled by who this little, always slightly hungry, rather thin, you know, British girl was. And one story I remember they sent me to was basically they were changing the laws around illegal gambling. And there was a demonstration against the change of the law by all these illegal gamblers. It was street gambling. And so I turn up at Times Square with my tape recorder to interview the people who are demonstrating. And of course, I hadn't realised this would be the case, but the illegal gamblers who did these games outside were all very big black blokes and very jovial. And I walk up with my tape recorder and they are so bemused. First of all, most of them have never met anyone from the UK. And, you know, I'm very politely asking them about, well, you know, why do you think it's all right to do this gambling, blah, blah, blah. But it was just that thing of realising a tape recorder and the right spirit could get you into anywhere. So I came back from New York and I went to the London College of Printing, which actually did a brilliant course on radio journalism. And I worked my socks off. I got glandular fever. My parents had just split up, so there was no money. So I had to also do cleaning jobs during that period. At one point, I was so poor, I had to apply for a grant to buy a bed. And so I was working really hard on the radio stuff, and I was working really hard to earn money. I know lots of kids do that now, but it was quite new to us. And of course, I fell over with glandular fever. I went out to do my first, you know, assignment where you get given to a radio station was fine. It was in Radio Merseyside, which was absolutely brilliant experience. And my second was at Radio Tees, where I fell over with glandular fever. I'd also worked on Newsbeat, which was fantastic. So this course really was the one that changed my professional capabilities. And I came top despite the glandular fever.
I've been what friends call a journalist and non-friends call a goddamn reporter all my working life, largely because I like it, and even more because I never knew how to do anything else.
I remember I interviewed James Cameron, who only people of my sort of age will remember, who was an extraordinary Guardian journalist who went everywhere. He was in his later years. He was very pleased to do the interview, but he didn't half like strong sherry. And he poured this sherry down me. I actually like sherry, but, you know, it was just far too much. And when I got the tapes back, it was absolutely incomprehensible what both of us were saying. And I rang up and said, can I come and do it again? His wife said, no, he's too tired. So I had to find another interviewee. But it was sort of, you know, these things are actually what you learn from. Totally what you learn from.
Cold winter mornings like radio tea keeps you warm.
I'd done an attachment at Radio Tees, as I said, and the editor there, a lovely man called Mike Best, moved from Radio Tees to Radio Air, which was a new radio station on the River Air in Leeds. And I always say that I got happy in Leeds because I've always been bold about the next big step. So I was in London, but I went up to Leeds where I knew not a soul and actually had a ball. Started at Radio Air, helped form a new newsroom, which is really interesting.
You're listening to test transmissions from the Independent Broadcasting Authority. These transmissions are in preparation for the new independent local radio service for West Yorkshire, which will be provided by the West Yorkshire Broadcasting Company Limited.
It had really high editorial aspirations, as lots of commercial radio stations did around news at that time. And in a way, we've lost something in losing that. And it was fantastic to be there at the beginning where you're setting up your contacts, you're learning how to make the radio car work, how to make the cart machine work. And I worked with some people who went on to work for me in the end. Mark Mardell and various others. Fabulous news editor in Mike Best, fabulous deputy editor who became a very big presenter called Krista Aykroyd, was there just as the Yorkshire Ripper story was coming to its conclusion, and it was fantastically good grounding. The newsroom, I look back on it, I think that was a really good local radio newsroom. But it's very hard to make radio work as a business, and in the end they just weren't getting the advertising in, which is why they had to retrench. And it was sad. I was really sad, but it's always given me a huge affinity with commercial radio. Lots of people in commercial radio think BBC people are a bit snooty. And some of them can be, and I just never have, because I've always respected the aspiration, certainly when I was working there, and the connection with the audience that they have brilliantly. And actually, they have to turn a buck, and that's a different place to be. And I applied for voluntary redundancy. I got £2,000, and I literally got offered two jobs at the BBC within about a month.
This is BBC Radio Leeds.
So off to the BBC. That was a bit of a culture shock, I can tell you. There was a sort of underlying pomposity that I found very difficult. In fact, I remember someone quite senior at Radio Leeds saying, I'm not sure you're really BBC. And what he really meant by that is you're too irreverent, because I'm actually BBC through to my fingertips. But I think pompous men are very hilarious, and I like to have a good time. I'm really hardworking, but that thing of enjoying the team, enjoying the product, doing it all. And there were some lovely people at Radio Leeds. I really enjoyed it. But I did realise when I'd done the Leeds Carnival 3 years in a row that it was time to look elsewhere. So I then started to do freelance working for Radio 4 while still doing a day job. Because if you do shifts, you get days off or chunks of days off. I mean, again, I'm sure the risk of glandular fever was quite high because I was working really hard. But I got involved with an environmental programme that had just started on Radio 4 called Groundswell. And I did stuff for You and Yours, and I did stuff for Women's Hour. And then Michael Green, who became eventually a controller of Radio 4, must have heard me do something and thought, she's got a lovely voice. And I was asked to go and do Women's Hour once a month from Manchester, because that's when we went round, and that was amazing. I remember being sick with nerves, but actually I like live broadcasting, so once I got over my terror, I really enjoyed it. It was genuinely very interesting. That's what the BBC can offer you, you know, this range of experience. And because I wasn't remotely desperate to go to London, Again, quite unusual in a BBC person. I just relished what I did there, and I did features for Radio 4. I did some telly, which I enjoyed, but realised I was never cut out for telly. It bored me. I once fell asleep in a cameraman's car. I was so bored. I always had the wrong clothes for telly. There's a very funny shot of me where, first of all, I'm carrying a plastic bag. I mean, that's not what you're meant to do as a television presenter. And I'm really trying, but it never occurs to me. And then there's another one where the hem of my dress is dipped because it's obviously come down and nobody noticed. So they had to start editing round my clothing failures. And then there's another one. We did this film on a Leeds estate about stray dogs, because every day a huge number of stray dogs have to be rounded up. This still goes on. And then if they aren't collected within a certain time, they're put down and burned in big furnaces. There was me on this estate, and one of these dogs gets killed in a car accident. And it's all being filmed. And then you can see in the kind of side of the screen that, far from being the Kate Hady reporter reporting on the death of the dog, I'm kneeling with the owner of the dog with my arm round her because she's sobbing her eyes out. And, you know, I just never quite got it in telly. I was good. I got offered a job as a reporter for Panorama. And I turned it down. And I went back to radio because radio was my natural home. That was a period when I got offered a job as a reporter on Panorama by Glenn Wynne, and a reporter, Glenn Wynne Benson, and a reporter on Today by Phil Harding, and I turned both of them down. I absolutely knew that I wouldn't enjoy them as much as I was doing. It was slight, some of it was nerves, but more of it was real gut instinct. It's almost impossible to say what it was. I mentor lots of young people, and this may be less true now, although I'm not sure it is. I always say, it's good to have a plan, but you've got to also follow your instinct. And people, the number of blokes who've had plans, particularly, you know, to get to be Director General, and with the exception of Mark Thompson, none of them have made it. Mark did have a plan and he got there. I mean, he's incredibly calculated about it. But I never had a plan, and I'm opportunistic. I spot the possibilities. And I don't mind saying, that's a really kind offer, but that's not the right one for me. Self-knowledge is helpful. You don't have a lot of it when you're young, but I probably had slightly more than my fair share. So I went back to radio and everyone was astonished. And then I was made editor of File on 4, and then they expanded Current Affairs and I got into management. And I had a very wonderful boss who realised I'd probably be good at management, but knew I wouldn't know I would be. So he said, just do it as an attachment. Just try it for 6 months. The first month I became really depressed because there was no adrenaline. And what you realise when you're on the road, there's a lot of adrenaline every day. And I wasn't doing hard news, I was doing Current Affairs. But even so, you're meeting people, you're driving, you're always slightly late, blah, 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 blah. When you're in an office, suddenly you get a huge adrenaline slump. And I thought, actually, either you've got to really embrace this job and get into the editing side, being the editor, or you've got to go back on the road. You can't be half foot in, half foot out. So I committed myself to being the editor and absolutely loved it. And we went through a complete purple patch. We got tons of awards. And I learned a lot about managing people. I remember a wonderful producer, who's still a friend of mine, saying to me, you know when we do the run-throughs in a Monday when we're really, really tired? And I said, yes. She said, could you start with something nice about the programme? Because I know you're only finding the fault because we've got less than 24 hours to sort it out, but you do need to start with something good. And that was a brilliant piece of advice, because I'm actually very positive and affirming. But as an editor, when you're under pressure, it's very easy to just go, that work doesn't work, that doesn't work, that doesn't work, what do we do about that? I was managing the team of File on 4, which was small, quite volatile, some of the characters. I was managing a budget. I was managing the profile of the programme within a very busy BBC firmament. I was managing the relationship with London because we were based in Manchester. So it was a very good, rounded experience. And the other thing is, because Manchester then had Current Affairs, comedy, specialist folk music, wonderful features, Woman's Hour, you really got a sense of how brilliantly rich the BBC experience can be. So then love entered the picture, because I fell in love with the man who's now my husband. We've been together for over 34 years. And he was a local newspaper man and was about to move to London to go and work for Eddie Shah's Today. And I thought, oh God, because I'd seen my future in the north, really. So I went to see somebody, I think I went to see Tony Hall, actually, who was running All of News, and said, I'd like a move, is that possible? And he thought I was much younger than I was, because then I did look a lot younger than I was, and was quite surprised. And I could see something ticking over in his brain. And actually what was ticking over in his brain was, oh my God, we're really short of women in management. She seems quite good. So they were creating this new role called business programmes, and a department called business programmes, which I can honestly say nobody in BBC News wanted to happen. And this became very evident when I got the job, arrived in London to find I had an office, but I didn't have a desk, a telephone, a secretary or a budget for 3 months. I would literally come in at 7 o'clock in the morning and take down the messages that people had left on the answer phone and then try and sort them out. And at that point, I met some people who I still know really well because they just waded in to help me. But the BBC can be a brutal place if it turns... It wasn't personal to me. It's just a whole load of people didn't think this department should exist. So I ran that, and that was interesting because it was running a department that, as I say, nobody wanted, but was full of great people. And that thing of taking on slightly unloved parts of the organisation has always been a bit of a characteristic. I mean, clearly when I went to Radio 4, that wasn't the case. But staying in Manchester, you know, not especially loved, taking on business programmes. I had to close a programme. I had to close Business Breakfast. That was hard. They then asked me to run a whole new strategy as well as doing my day job, which I absolutely loved. I like strategy because I like audiences. We did the strategy and everybody ignored it, so there you go. But as a consequence of that, Tony then asked me not just to do business programmes, but to run Current Affairs, which was television and radio. That was quite hard because Current Affairs people are very, very bolshy. And I learned to shout back. I remember when Greg came around to see them and he was really shocked at how vigorous the debate was between me and my staff. And neither me nor they thought anything of it because it was quite affectionate, but it's just the way those people engage. I think I was a little bit out of my depth in all honesty, but I stuck up for the right things. You know, I stuck up for the independent journalism, but it was a huge management task and I got very little help for it. I was the most junior member of the management team and I had to make the first compulsory redundancies in news in 10 years and not a single more senior manager came and helped me. And I've never let that happen to anyone else. And I found the intensity of the competition between the blokes really baffling. And there's a lot of tedious rhetoric that goes on in BBC meetings.
So first up, we nix the whole anti-BBC crap, OK? It's gone, OK, get over it, path forward. The BBC is like the stepmum you always wished you had instead of the stepmum you actually ended up with.
The satirical series W1A is a wonderful satire by John Morton. And because it's wonderful, it's because it's not true, but it's true enough. And of course, it's true enough not just to the BBC, it's true enough of any organisation, particularly a big organisation. I learned a lot from that experience, but it wasn't a very comfortable experience to be so marginalised, actually. And it wasn't deliberate by anybody. Nobody, you know, thought, oh, she's the woman, we'll do this. But it's just, it was just very challenging. And I talk to women now who have that experience. You know, that experience of you say something and it doesn't land. And three men down, they say exactly the same thing. And the chair goes, oh, that's a very good point. Now, I have to say that happens to blokes too, but it happens even more to women. There's a sort of blind spot. But, you know, it was a great growing experience, and editorially I loved it because I love Current Affairs. And of course I also ran radio. Gwyn, who's now controller of Radio 4, was running radio. And you know, Gwyn and I have worked together for years and years and years in different ways, and that was genuinely very happy. That was, you know, that was a great relationship. And I sort of liked some of those tough old buggers on Panorama, you know, the ones who hated management. They'd all been to boarding school and they'd all got authority issues. And actually being a woman in that was very interesting because they were slightly baffled as to what you did with a woman boss. And Glenwyn was a fantastic editor of Panorama because she was so patient and gentle. She'd just left, but I'd watched her do that. It was very interesting. So after that, I then was released into the glorious job. One of the happiest jobs I've ever done was running Radio 4.
BBC News. This is Peter Donaldson.
And working for Jenny Abramsky with a fantastic team of controllers. I came in after James Boyle, who'd been a very, very controversial controller because he'd changed the schedule. Almost everything he did, I actually agree with. And I was public about that. But it was very important to do calm and consolidation. And I did lots of relatively modest things with the schedule, like early morning I cleaned up. But I just thought, this audience has had enough of schedule changes. And radio's habitual. You have to get to know it over time. So let's just focus on the quality of the content. Let's get that right. Our audiences went up. They got to over 10 million, which was the highest it had ever been up till then. I mean, it's gone above that now. And we won Sony Station of the Year 2 years in a row, never having won it before. So I was incredibly, superficially, but incredibly pleased by these things, because it was a sort of, it was taking Radio 4 from just being loved or not loved, but taken for granted, you know, the great stately ship of Radio 4. Or the other thing, of course, I did was, you know, with my team, you never do these things on your own. We created BBC 7, which became Radio 4 Extra.
BBC Radio 7.
Absolutely fascinating. I have to say, I could not have done it without a woman called Wendy Pilmer, who is a force of nature and brilliant at that sort of organisational structural change, because this was a archive station without live news that had to be done on a shoestring. And there were huge rights issues because it was archive stuff. Sometimes people think naively the BBC owns all its programmes. Of course it doesn't. I don't just mean the indies, but the IP around, you know, comedy writing is all owned by someone else. So that was a really big task. But we got it on air, and we got it on air successfully, and Mary Callum Kerrion was a wonderful controller. I was quite good at that time as spotting people who were over 50, who the BBC was rather keen on getting rid of everyone over 50, and giving them jobs. So I got Mary to come on board, and I got somebody called Gordon House to come and run drama, who's still fantastic. I mean, he is retired now, they're still doing a bit of work. But it was absolutely getting staff to understand our core audience. And our core audience, average age 53, lived through baby boomers, lived through tail end of the war, the 60s, the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's a whole load. I wanted staff to start seeing audiences as fertile ground for creative ideas, not just people who listened. So I did a lot of presentations about audiences and what would have shaped their experience, how you emotionally connect to them. And it's a bit like early music, the pop music you had as a child and teenager, you remember forever. When you're running Radio 4, the irony is you don't actually run the news. All of news under John Burt was put under news, and actually that was bloody sensible. So Hutton happened under my watch, but I had nothing to do with it because it was all news. I just had to watch the appalling sort of unpeeling and falling apart. But running Radio 4 is really interesting because you have to know it beyond your intellectual knowing. You have to have an instinct for what its most conservative audiences can tolerate and how you get the next generation in. So one of the most radical things I did was I put Stephen Fry reading Harry Potter all one Boxing Day on FM. I moved the rest of the programming to Longwave.
Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal.
And this was before the days of social media or even email. So I got over 200 letters, which is really a lot. And they were unbelievably rude, you know, colonels in the shires condemning me for my indulgence of the young. And I stuck to my guns, obviously, and Christmas tends to be a television event, so we did some special measuring, and we got over 4 million people listening. So it was a huge, huge success in all sorts of ways. But it was bold, I knew that the audience, most of them, would give it a chance. And we got all these letters from people saying afterwards. I got loads of letters afterwards saying, we all got together with a picnic and sat and listened for 8 hours, or we listened for the first 2 hours and then came back to it at the end of the day. It was actually quite a seminal moment, because having done that, other stations did things like bark all Christmas on Radio 3. I'd sort of bust the schedule in a way that's become much more the norm. And I'm not saying I was the first person to ever do it, but I think I was probably the first person to do it in quite that way. But you do have to be very, very respectful of how much the habitual nature of Radio 4 matters to its core audience. And that core audience can listen for 12 hours a day.
Last week, Today new boy Justin Webb told me he's planning to be a bit more combative in his interviewing style on the programme. This provoked a fairly combative reaction from many of you.
You can't be trapped by them. You've got to innovate. But if you do it without explanation or really thinking it through, they will punish you. And that becomes uncomfortable for the BBC. At that point, the most vulnerable time for the BBC in terms of its core supportive audience was when we managed to turn the schedule of Radio 4 upside down under James Boyle, which caused outrage. So James changed the schedule by shortening and moving a lot of programmes and abolishing and creating new ones. And that's because Radio 4 is such a complex jigsaw puzzle. It's very difficult to do small changes without having an impact much further down the schedule. He was very audience-driven in terms of consumption, but he probably wasn't as adroit as you needed to explain why he was doing it. And he made what, to me, is something I wouldn't have done, is he made a statement about being on the side of the listener. And you have to be really careful about that. I would not personally have put it like that, because the listener will decide if you're on their side, not you. So he did some bold, brave and correct things, but there was huge controversy. It really was. It went on and on and on. And when I became controller, the first thing they wanted me to do is extend The World at One again to 45 minutes. And I looked at the figures, and frankly, at 27 minutes past, the audience drops quite dramatically. So I couldn't see the point of that. Gwyn has done it, but it hasn't actually, in audience terms, that decline still happens. So James was essentially right.
Now, just before we go, once upon a time, this programme ended like this.
That's The World at 1:40.
That's The World at 1:40.
I'm Gitter Harry. That was The World at 1:40.
Then we shrunk in the wash of a scheduling shakeout. And for the last 13 years, it's been like this.
This is Nick Clark. That's The World at 1:30.
I'm Brian Henran, and that's The World at 1:30.
I'm Sean Lay, and that's The World at 1:30.
This is Martha Carney. That's The World at 1:30.
As of Monday, we shall be back in a full-length ball gown, even longer than it was, in fact, a full 45 minutes.
I mean, interestingly, much more powerful in that those terms is that people do still come to The World at One at lunchtime, but of course, because of mobile phones, they also go to a whole load of other things. So Radio 4, I was loving, and then we had the whole huge bust-up with government over the Andrew Gilligan report.
The government's facing more questions this morning over its claims about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Our defence correspondent is Andrew Gilligan. This in particular, Andy, is Tony Blair saying they'd be ready to go within 45 minutes.
That's right. That was a central claim in his dossier. Which
and Mark Thompson came and said, I'd like you to go and run news. And I thought, you must be bloody joking. And then someone said to me, it's not really a question, Helen. It's an order. And I was completely taken aback by that, because I had genuinely, until that moment, not realised that slightly menacing side of the BBC, you know, make you an offer you can't refuse. And I said, well, what will he do? What will they do if I say no? And this person, who was very wise, just said, well, they won't do anything active, but if you have some really bad figures on Radio 4, you'll suddenly find they're just not very supportive. And by that time anyway, I think because I'd done so much journalism, I was ready to do it. But the first year running news was really difficult, because it was going from an intimate, hugely enjoyable thing, Radio 4, to, with massive audience focus, to a huge, huge part of the organisation where all you ever got was flack, both internally and externally. So I was used to people saying, oh, Radio 4, how marvellous. I pay the licence fee alone for Radio 4. And when you run news, they say, I hate what BBC News did on this story. And you sit there waiting for the but. You know, it's a marvellous service. You never get the but. It's always negative. And you get politicians ringing you up. You get governors interfering, trustees interfering. You get a lot of pressure in a lot of ways. But over time, I became accustomed to it and loved a lot of it. My favourite time was 2008, when the economic crash happened.
Well, it'll be big. It is the government's attempt to stabilise the banking system. Treasury has been working on it for weeks. Things came to a head.
And when I say it was my favourite, it was my most interesting as head of news. And we had Robert Preston breaking story after story after story. And of course, I didn't need him to tell me who the sources were of these stories, but I did need to know it had been double sourced, actually. And with Robert, it was always triple sourced. So, and you know, we were accused of affecting the crash. I mean, that simply wasn't true. I'm incredibly proud of the way we handled the kidnapping of Alan Johnson in Gaza. And I'm proud of actually how I handled that, because I went up to see his parents frequently. I was very supportive of them. I behave like a proper human being as well as a boss, and sometimes that doesn't always happen. I'm incredibly proud of some of the journalism we did throughout, and actually I'm hugely proud of leading the team that created the multimedia newsroom. That multimedia newsroom that you see on the 10 o'clock news came from me making a decision. We were going to make it happen, and it took 2 years. And ironically, by the time it was opened by the Queen, I'd moved to radio. And it was a total team effort, don't get me wrong. But teams need bosses, and I was the person that led that through. So there's a load I'm proud of, actually. A load I'm proud of.
Hello, Matthew Bannister here. I'm standing on the balcony at the very front of Broadcasting House in the centre of London, waiting for the Queen to arrive. In the next hour, Her Majesty is coming officially to open the BBC's new headquarters, which houses all of its TV and radio news operations, both domestic and international, under one roof for the very first time. Thousands of people were...
And then, of course, I had the hideous experience of, you know, being accused of suppressing the journalism over Jimmy Savile, which was a brutal experience. Brutal in several ways. First of all, I spent my career helping journalists get things on air, so it was very painful to be accused of a lack of integrity. And then there's this weird thing where the BBC puts you on trial. So this organisation you've sort of loved turns on you, and it's really frightening. And they say you've got to have a lawyer. And they say, we'll pay for the lawyer, but the lawyer is your lawyer, not the BBC's. And Nick Pollard, also a radio person, did his six-week multi-million pound investigation, and discovered that, no, I hadn't suppressed the journalism. In fact, I hadn't been. The editor made a wrong call, which is what we always knew. And that there were clearly a lot more tensions in that team than I'd ever realised. But then I was running 8,000 people. And he was critical of me. And I look back and I think, do you know, some of that was reasonable and some of it was a bit unfair given the context of 8,000 people. But I've never complained about it because that was his view.
How do you try to restore trust in BBC News now?
BBC News' trust has never really diminished. It's still the most trusted news organisation in this country.
Can it still be trusted with you at the helm?
Oh, it was really hard. The thing is, I've got incredible determination, I realise. I realise I am a tough old boot. And if I'd been guilty, I might have just given up the ghost. But I just thought, this is outrageous. I mean, I wasn't angry. I was just solidly determined. And the thing about really bad times is that there are people who behave really badly, and most of them are utterly predictable. And then a lot of people behave really well. And I can tell you the people, but I won't, who literally avoided me in the corridor. There was one very famous female presenter who literally swerved into the ladies as I came along in case she was tainted by being seen with me. And there were other things, like when I'd been stepped aside, this weird thing happened, which was a story went out on poor Lord McAlpine that was palpably untrue, because I'd been recused, as the word, I'd chosen to have nothing to do with any child sex abuse stories, because obviously there was this cloud over me at that point. I knew nothing about this. And to deal with this, the BBC put me and my deputy to one side, which was a very interesting reaction. Tim Davey rang me after this had happened and said, I'm really sorry about this. I mean, he'd done it to me, and I knew he was right. And I said to him, I don't really care if you're sorry or not. You're inside the building and I'm outside. And he said, well, you can certainly come in. And, you know, you can't do editorial, but there's loads of other stuff you can do. And I walked into this was the old newsroom in Television Centre, and it was the Today programme and BH and PM and Water and all those Radio 4 sequences. And Eddie Mayer stood up and started clapping. And everybody stood up and started clapping. It was incredibly moving. And somebody said, you should leak that to the papers. And I said, no, it would be inappropriate. But it was remarkably affirming. There were a lot of people who went the extra mile for me, as well as some people who couldn't wait to have me beheaded so they could get my job. So then Tony came back, and Tony just said, you know, Tim was going to Worldwide. He just said, you were born to do radio. Would you like to go and do radio? You've had enough of news, I should think. And again, I don't think it was really a question, but actually the fact was I was thrilled to come back to radio. And radio people were, by and large, fairly thrilled to have me. I mean, there were the few sort of rhetorical questions, why are we getting secondhand goods kind of thing? And they asked me that. Not with much heart in it, I have to say, at the radio festival. And I just said the proof of the pudding. But overwhelmingly, in both commercial and BBC radio, there was just great support. I remember John Simon saying to me at the... you know, John Myers invited me onto his table at the Radio Awards, and John came up to me and he said, I just watched you go through that, and I just thought, she's a radio person. You know, that quiet, just don't respond, just get through it. And I have loved this 4 years. I mean, I've really loved it. And I'm sad to be going, but Tony's reorganised again. He, you know, wants to give radio to someone. Well, he has now given radio to somebody else. That's his right. They offered me another big job, I've never done big jobs for their own sake. You can tell that. You know, if you turn down Panorama and you turn down the day programme, you're certainly not going to take on the bloody nations when you know another person should do it because they do it better than you, and also that it doesn't play to your strengths. And I'm 60, so I just thought, I'm really delighted that my last job is director of radio. So that's what I'm doing. Well, I'm going to Harvard for 16 weeks to do a fellowship, which is a bit alarming because it's very academic, and I'm going to do it on public service broadcasting. And then I'm going to cast around, really, because I don't think I want to do another big job, because actually it's rather nice not to have quite so much responsibility. I want to stay economically active because, you know, I am only 60, but I also want to do some arts and music pro bono work. And I really actually want to stay connected to the media industry, because both in radio terms and in journalism terms, it's interesting when you suddenly realise you've got quite a lot to offer. You've got a lot to offer in terms of experience, insight, a bit of wisdom, I think, as you get older. I've done a lot. I've had a 34-year career. I've done a huge range of jobs. I've been through some tough old times. And I suddenly thought, you know, that might be interesting to people. Travis Baxter invited me to do their away days in Stockholm, which was fab, and he asked me to come and talk about the future of radio, and it was such an interesting experience. They'd never had the BBC there before, and of course we had far more in common than we had apart, which has always been my message in this job. The radio industry in this country is very small, and it needs to hang together much more than it does. I think the challenge of the young is real and serious, and I think it's not that they're not listening in large numbers. I mean, we still get over 10 million listening to Radio 1, but they've got so much more to do with their time, and building a habit of radio listening is harder. I suppose, and I maybe prove totally wrong on this, but radio is always essentially about a relationship. It's the relationship of the presenter to you, and it feels very one-to-one. And that, to me, is an enduring human need, and I don't think that's going to disappear. It's also quite culturally specific. So trying to do global products in radio, global programmes that appeal to people from very different cultures, works well enough when it's all about the music. But if you actually want more of a sense of connection to the presenter, you know, my humour is going to be different from somebody in Germany's or somebody in the States. So I think there's some enduring human needs that play to what radio is really good at. I think speech radio will continue to flourish, actually, and I think it will grow, and obviously we see the growth of podcasts. I mean, podcasts are very important, but still most radio is overwhelmingly live. And podcasts in the States are doing well because radio in the States is very, very, very samey. And actually, if you listen to a lot of American podcasts, they are also very samey. So whilst the quality of BBC radio and actually UK radio is as good as it is, I think we will certainly keep the over 50s with us. It's just whether or not we can bring in the next generation. I suppose the other thing is, I'm also trying to be open generally, because it would be foolish just to stuff my life with things to do as opposed to things that I might enjoy doing and which would genuinely be valuable, you know, like you're doing now, finding a pleasure. I'm trying to do a CV, which I'm useless at. And when I looked at it, I thought, wow, that is quite impressive. I'm bloody hopeless at saying, gosh, Helen, you've done well. I don't have that gene. I mean, of course, you know, there are things and events and relationships that I'm proud of, but I don't quite connect. So even this going to Harvard, it's like it's happening to someone else. And I think in the end, that's not a bad thing. I see a lot of, and this is usually men, young men, who have a massive sense of entitlement, and it drives me bloody bonkers. And they're usually posh young men, and it just, it's deeply unattractive, and they don't deserve it most of the time. Some of them do. And there's a bit of me is genuinely sad that my mum and dad saw make me more success than they'd ever thought of, but I think they would be staggered by all this. But equally, they'd be very low-key about it. Because the thing about 50s children, and probably 60s children, is they grew up in environments that were quite emotionally austere, by and large. You didn't boast about things. You didn't go on. You know, all this self, self, self that modern media has encouraged, it's just not the way you were raised. You know, when I got my 11 plus, first of all, my father thought it must have been a mistake. I thought I literally went to the school and said, if she's a borderline case, she's such a highly strung child, I don't want her going to a grammar school where she'll be unhappy. And they said, no, she wasn't a borderline case, she was in the top 5%. So I went to grammar school. I remember my mum saying, well, just think about all the poor children who didn't get it. And that's the way you were raised. And that kind of austere background still has many merits, I think. It can make you unconfident, but it can also make you respectful of other people's experiences. And that feels quite important. And I see the born to rule, very entitled people in the BBC. There's not many of them, and they're mostly near the top. And I'm glad I'm not like them. When I came in today, the security lady just gave me the most enormous hug. And she said, we're going to miss you so much. And I just thought, I don't think there's many other executive board members that would have had that reception at the news of their going. And that matters a lot to me, far more than some great and good person telling me.
Helen Bowden on Conversations. The programme was a Radio Moments production.
I'd like to be remembered as caring really deeply about programmes, people and the BBC's public service values, which are so precious and which we really mustn't trade away.